Hey guys, this is Imran. You might be wondering where your regular free-to-play cast is. This week we were lucky enough to have Steve Gaynor of the Fulbright Company, the people that brought you the incredible Gone Home, to join us and talk about the game. I just want to make it clear that we really spoil this game, and while it's a great listen with tons of insight in what they accomplished with Gone Home, you should probably play the game first. It's really good, so just go ahead and do it. We'll be back next week with regular free-to-play. Until then, enjoy our chat with Steve Gaynor.
It's August 26, 2013, and in this episode of 47 of Free to Play, also the first Free to Play episode of Cyburn, our interview-focused podcast. I'm Brian Belita, joined by the usual crew, Mark Bradshaw, head of our New York office, located in the computer desk in his apartment.
Hey, y'all, what's up?
Imran Khan, professional.
I ain't afraid of no ghost.
And Matt Pierce, our very own John Carmack slash getaway driver.
Yeah, I kind of know things.
And I also have the pleasure today of welcoming Steve Gaynor of the Portland, Oregon-based Fulbright Company, who are behind the recently released and very well-received story exploration video game, as I quote from their site, Gone Home. Steve, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we'll of course, be talking about Gone Home today. We're just going to go ahead and say that there will be spoilers, and during which I hope we're able to ask Steve at least some questions that he hasn't been asked already in this past week. I'm sure you've done about a billion interviews and podcasts. So let's see, it came out on what, the 15th?
Yes, it did.
Okay, so it's been almost 2 weeks now, yeah.
Yeah.
But then it's also my hope that we'll talk about not Gone Home, because we have Steve Gaynor on the show, a gentleman a lot of people follow, and has been in game design for a while, so I'm always interested to pick his brain and people's brains about other things in the video game industry.
Yeah, so, whatever you want to talk about. Let's do it.
Yeah, awesome. Well, let's talk about Gone Home first, which is a video game that you just put out. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I'm really good. Really glad that it's done very well. My first question, do you know how many people finished it in one sitting?
We don't have like data on that. We aren't right. NSAing you or anything. but we got a lot of reports from people. The most enjoyable reports are the ones we had a number of people like tweet or something to us that they were like, oh, I was going to turn it on just for a couple minutes to see how it ran. And then 3 hours later, I finished it, which is cool, you know. But yeah, I think a lot of people did just get absorbed in it and go all the way through it in one sitting. I don't know kind of how common that is.
I'd be interested to see that, but I think we all did, right?
Yeah. I would be more interested to know like the numbers on like how many people like played through it in one sitting and how long it took people to realize there was no ghost or like axe murder involved. Because I like through the first 3/4 of the game, I was convinced that the ghost was still there somewhere.
Like, it wasn't minutes. What was the point where you're like, oh, I was talking this entire time?
I was still like opening up, I was making sure the doors were closed behind me because if the axe murderer was going to come in, he would have to open up the door first.
Yeah.
It just seemed that that's probably just good policy whenever you're going to somebody's home.
Yeah. That's good anti-serial killer acumen. I think that's the standard. Though, of course, the doors open in both directions in our game, so.
Oh, right. No. Oh, wow.
You thought you were safe.
Well, that's kind of an interesting question where we all thought we heard or saw things. I think the first main one for me was when you go down that left hallway from the foyer, from the stairwell. Yeah. And I was like, oh, there's a closet. And I popped open the closet and I started hearing this voice. And I kind of stopped and I held my breath and I go, all right, what is that? Is that just, what is that? And it took me, I think, no doubt, about 5 minutes of me just kind of sitting there, what is going on? What is happening? Before I kind of went down the hallway and realized there was the TV on with the weather display message. Other than that, obviously, kind of the creaking house, which you know, you guys put in some little notes or you know, little thing about the house being old and creaky and the electrical work and stuff like that. But I think that for me was the biggest one that stood out in my memory. That kind of triggered that gamer reflex of mine of wanting to survive or hide or that something was going to pop out at me.
For me, it was a little strange because I knew pretty early on that there was probably nothing that was going to kill me at some point.
Yeah,
like. nothing to really be scared of, but every time I entered a dark room, I immediately rushed for the light as quickly as I could.
Oh, God, yeah.
Just because it made me feel uncomfortable.
I think I read about a lot of people who just basically, you know, quickly open the door and immediately try to find the light switch and turn it on.
Because Daniel is somewhere in that house. He's going to kill you. I think there was two in the game. It's like first when you first go into like the main foyer and like that skull is just sitting there and it's this horrible white skull that's just reflecting light off. And it's like, oh God, why do they have a skull? It's just like this cheap $3 mech skull from like some trinket shop. But then you go upstairs and you see the horrible red lights around the attic.
Oh yeah,
in the dark room. And the first time I looked at it, I said, "Oh God, there's some devil worshipping stuff going on in there." I'm going to open that door. It's going to be Quake. And it's no. It's...
All of a sudden, I'm gone.
You know, the weird thing is that, you know, speaking of nostalgia, I when I was in high school, we lived in a house that was kind of like that. I mean, we only lived in an apartment in a larger house, but it had those sort of push button light switches from like the early 30s. So I was kind of used to that idea of a house. And at that time, my little brother had strung Christmas lights all around his room. So like when I got to the corner with the attic and saw the Christmas lights, it just reminded me of that house.
That's awesome, actually. So did you find it less scary then? Because you were like, oh, I know what this place is like.
I did the first floor first and then went upstairs. So I kind of had gotten, like I'd gotten past the room with the TV in it.
Right.
So, like, all those jitters kind of went away. But every time I got to a long hallway, I started thinking about The Shining. Right? I just expected an apparition at the end. Maybe that wasn't going to kill me or anything, but it took a while to shake that.
Yeah.
So was it sort of a conscious decision to kind of meet and then also break, I'd say, I guess, most people who play video games' thoughts that some sort of supernatural horror stuff was going to happen with, like, the TV voice in the distance as you go into that closet?
Well, okay, so the TV specifically, as a specific instance, that was initially just an accident. That, like, I didn't mean for you to be able to hear it
from the closet.
But then it was a weird kind of effect, so I left it. We do have an audio occlusion system, so I could have cut it off from the TV room, and you wouldn't have been able to hear it. But it seemed worth it just to have that really low kind of implication of a voice when you're in that space, because it's just sort of a strange, unsettling thing. I mean, that was what was important for us was just sorry to cut you off.
No.
For us, it was like, if we knew the game we were making, at the base of it was just, there's an empty house, there's nothing that's going to get you in it, and you just walk around and look at stuff, you know? But we also really wanted there to be a sense of urgency and, like, a feeling that you had to, you know, solve this mystery, right? Yeah. Like, that you're like, oh, I got to figure out what happened here, and not just sort of like, oh, I guess I'll just kind of wander around, look at stuff. It's no big deal, you know? Because, I don't know, I don't think that would have been especially engaging. It would have been a very different experience. It wouldn't have been the kind of thing that we were going for. And so we had to, rely on atmosphere for that and say, okay, if we say up front, there's nothing that's going to actually jump out and get you. This isn't like the Avoid the Serial Killer game. But we still want you to have that sense of unease and that feeling like you really need to solve this mystery. The way we could do it, you know, is say like, okay, it's a dark, old, creepy house. It's in the middle of the night. There's this storm going on. There's this imagery that you see in the house that at least at first puts you on edge, you know, before you know what it really means. And just to keep that feeling of like, something's not right here and I've got to figure out what it is.
Yeah.
And so then once we had said, you know, okay, well, we're signing up for this dark and stormy night kind of spooky atmosphere. How can we play with that and play with, you know, video game conventions and expectations? You know, like I've worked on every game that I've worked on, I guess. Has some scene of, you know, blood splatter decals being on a wall somewhere. And so, you know, the bathtub was very intentionally like, okay, I'm going to put some fucking blood splatter decals in this game. But, you know, and so you walk in there like, oh shit. But the thing that we wanted to do, you know, was keep like playing with your expectations. And when you would see kind of a loaded image that in other games that have a certain meaning, then subvert that when you found out what it actually meant. You know, because it's sort of like the thing, I wanted to emphasize, like, okay, this is just a story about a family that lives in a house, and they're a pretty normal family, and nothing crazy happened to them that might not have happened to somebody that you, like, lived next door to when you were growing up. And so that being kind of, like, the message or, like, the twist, the little, the subversive note when you do see, like, oh, is there blood splattered everywhere? Oh, no. It's just a normal family. Teenager was dyeing her hair. Like, yeah. That yeah. is what this game is really about, you know, yeah. is what I wanted.
Well, for what it's worth, I mean, even without like the sense of urgency that I got from the from hearing the TV from that closet, I think when I pushed play on that voice recorder, that second message sent chills right up my spine, and from there I was like, okay, I am Kate, and I need to figure out what is going on here, and that kind of created a sense of urgency for me.
Because that right before then, you got that first note about Daniel being a creep. And then Lonnie with the second note, because you didn't even know it's Lonnie at that point. You just right. yeah. I just assume it was her sister, and it's like she's just, you know, freaking out. That's why her voice was different. So despite the fact that you know there's like no real threat to you, you did an amazing job just creating a sense of dread and tension even without that. And that's something that is very difficult in video games. So I mean, people try to get tension right, and usually you fail. So without like any threat like presented toward the player, amazing job at creating tension.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, well, I don't know if this is like a common thing for most players, but from my experiences, because I've had to deal with people in my life that have committed suicide and I've lost friends to that the urgency for me and the fear that gripped me most of that game was I was deathly afraid that Sam was going to end up dead.
Yeah.
And I was going to find her body somewhere, and that part of the reason that was an emotional wreck during most of that game, and especially when you got that note to say that we're going to be under the stairs, because for some reason I interpreted that as we're going to kill ourselves under the stairs.
Yeah, and the words were, this is where we're going to do it.
Yeah. 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 And I didn't pay attention to anything else in that house right then. I ran straight there, just, I don't know why, but yeah. I felt something like really raw right then that I couldn't ever probably explain to you in words.
Well, I mean, I think I know what you mean, and that's something that I didn't want to play with or be glib with, you know, because like, yeah, it's something that if someone's had that in their life, it's not something that you can take lightly. So I didn't want to be like manipulative or like,
right,
you know, be pushing someone's buttons in that way, because that's like really callous, you know, like, because there was somebody that wrote, there's a woman who played it and she wrote a poem, and it was a poem about a similar thing where it was like in her life, She had gotten home, and there was an answering machine message from her friend telling her that she was going to kill herself, and that she went to her house, and she didn't make it in time. And like, she was thinking about that when she was playing our game, and like, that's super heavy. And so you know, like, it's hard to make a game that even points towards those kinds of themes, even through implication. And I tried my best not to do it in a way that was, that, you know, treated it lightly. So I hope that you didn't feel like it was like an exploitative use of those kinds of images or anything.
Speaking personally, it was the first time I've ever seen a video game, probably a piece of media, that actually like reached that part of me, like that reminded me of how it felt at the time, but still it didn't feel manipulative or emotionally callous in any way.
Okay, that's good to hear, because I mean, I'm lucky not to have had that kind of experience in my own life, and so I would hate for it to be like, you know, that I'm using that part of someone else's experience in a way that's not respectful or whatever. But it's just so hard when you are gonna talk about anything that comes from someone that might have happened to somebody, you know, and bring up those memories. It's a hard line to draw about how you address stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think you guys did it very well. I mean, without kind of explicitly, you know, pointing out and saying, hey, this is, you know, you should feel about this. You allowed the player to kind of make their own decision or come to their own conclusion, like, oh, what if this is it? And not really thinking, okay, this is it. This just happened. Which I think when the player comes to that realization themselves, it does touch more kind of to maybe an inner, more emotional part that they had in them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I know this is a weird transition to go to, but when you mentioned blood decals, you said the word,
yeah.
I immediately started thinking of a Viscera cleanup detail level in Gone Home. And I'm sorry for that.
But I would play it. I don't, like, I like that game. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. They just did an update today.
I still need to check it out. I've seen a lot of video and coverage of it, but I've yet to check it out. So I know.
At least I'm proud of the fact that there would be a lot less work for the player to do in our game.
It's just in the bathroom. Just go right up there. But it's not blood.
So yeah. Do the blood spatters just come with the game engine when you license it?
it seems like they must be default for most game engines. With Unity, they don't ship them. But
So I have a quick question about your guys' office in Portland, Oregon. The house, is that like strictly just an office for you guys, or is it also where you live?
We split a house here in town, and our office is in the basement. So
it's cool. And is it the whole Fulbright team that lives there?
Everybody except for Kate. Kate, our 3D artist, lives up in Vancouver, BC, with her wife, Emily, who did like the title art, like the painting of the house.
For
the
game. Nice.
And her handwriting is the handwriting font, you know, that the.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask about that. If you actually got kind of a the kids' notes when when Sam was younger, when she was writing the stories,
yeah.
The Fantastic Void is did she do that stuff?
No, so the font that I'm talking about is like when you mouse over something and it says like open door or whatever, you know, like yeah, when you say oh look it's a ghost game, that stuff is all in. Emily did handwriting and then we turned it into a font, but no, all the other notes in the game for the most part were every individual different character was written by a different person in most cases. In a couple cases it wasn't true. Like for instance, Carla did Oscar's handwriting, you know, and just like did a very careful job of this like spidery old, you know, cursive writing because we didn't. We got our moms to write all of them, you know, like the letters from Carol to Jan and the letter from Daniel's mom and stuff because you can't fake the handwriting of like a 50-year-old woman who was.
Well, no, I was gonna say that's
school in the '60s.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's really neat because I don't know that there's such a thing as a professional note writer, you know, for video games or for, you know, use in movies or something like that.
Well, if they made for just video games, they probably don't make a lot of money anymore. It's
true. Yeah.
It's probably specifically gone home within the past 15 years.
Aww.
But the little kid handwriting, there are like a few different stages of writing in of Sam's stories, and the youngest one, the one that she's talking about, like going in the woods with Daniel and everything. So you saw the update about how Lee Petty from Double Fine, the art director of Double Fine,
yeah.
did the Super Nintendo cartridges.
For the cartridges, yeah.
Yeah, and he offered to have his daughter, who's like 5 years old, do like little kid handwriting, little kid drawings for us. So the youngest one, from when Sam was like 5 or 6, was written by Ruby Petty, Lee Petty's daughter, and she also did the drawings of the pirates and the drawing of Sam and Daniel like standing outside the house and stuff. Because similar to mom handwriting, you can't fake how a 5-year-old writes and draws stuff if you're 30.
Yeah,
no, like you
really can't. Yeah. Yeah.
And now she has portfolio work, so that's great for her.
her first video game credit, unless she's gotten something into a Double Fine.
But, imagine baby developers.
But it was really cool because, like, you know, I wrote all the text and dialogue stuff in the game, and so I wrote the little kid stories. And I tried doing misspellings and stuff the way that I remembered them from when I was a kid. But very smartly, Lee Petty, when he was getting his daughter to write the text for that story, instead of giving her the written, like the typed version that I provided him, he read it out loud to her and told her to write it down so that she would really spell things wrong the way that a little kid would spell them, which was really, really cool.
That so cool. Do you remember the differences in it? Like, did she do worse than you did, or?
she probably did overall have, I mean, one of the biggest things is, like, consistency, you know? Like, there's just certain rules that you learn about, like, where periods and apostrophes and commas and stuff go that you just kind of do automatically, and so that stuff was less regular in the version that she did, and there was also less regular misspellings of stuff. Like she would spell pirate like three different ways in the same story and stuff like
that. Excellent. Yeah.
But the thing that I was proud of was, I think I remembered from when I was a little kid, I wrote a story that had something to do with saying I, captain, you know, like you see in a cartoon or whatever.
Sure.
And I spelled it as just capital I, you know, because whatever. And so that was how I had typed it in my typed version. And then when we got the version from Lee's daughter, she had written it that same way when you'd read it out loud to her. So I got that one right. That was cool.
I thought you were going to say that you had always typed it that way. And then when you actually submitted this, somebody pointed to it. Hey, Steve, you do know that it's spelled A-Y-E, right? And that's you had just been writing it capital I your whole life.
Yeah. No, not quite, but close.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Daniel and Street Fighter, I know Mark has a question involving this.
Well, yeah, it's the question like most people I think at first pops up in their head when they play this game and the pressing one to everyone's mind. What exactly does Sam main? Because we know Lonnie mains Chun-Li, so who does Sam play? I'm going to assume it's Ryu because she's kind of straight laced when she first meets Lonnie.
They both play Chun-Li.
Oh,
smart girls.
Not, they burst. Do have taste. Yeah. So I was gonna hope it was Blanca because it's a little punkish. But okay, all
right. Right, a little punk spikes. Yeah.
I mean, I could see Lonnie playing someone other than Chun-Li, but I think that was how it worked out. That's my internal expectation. Though there's no canon explanation for who played. I mean, one assumes that Sam played Chun-Li because she had the Chun-Li moves list written on that thing, you know, in her room. Lonnie's more of an X Factor.
Jeez. What did I think about? Damn so, it.
One thing that kind of unnerved me was that, like, all the AV equipment was missing in the house.
Yeah.
And it took me the longest time to realize, okay, maybe Sam and Lonnie took all the stuff and sold it off, you know, for money to go run away. But I also assume it's so you didn't have to actually include fully watchable episodes of X-Files in the game.
Yes, it's both of those.
Yeah.
It's one of those practical constraints that then led to a fictional...
Right.
You know, explanation where it's like, okay, we definitely want to put VHS tapes in the game. But we definitely cannot let you put them into a VCR. So we're going to have VHS tapes and no VCR. And then they're like, okay, that makes sense. Okay, she threw them in the back of the car because you can pawn those for a lot if you're in 1995. Kind of. And especially for dad is getting like high grade, you know, AV equipment from his job.
Right, like a laser disc.
Right.
I just assumed that Terrence had to send them back when he was done.
But there must be at least one in use at the time, right? Like, presumably the thing in the VCR, in the TV room, I would guess, was a combination VHS, CD, Laserdisc player, which could probably go for a lot. But again, there isn't a canon explanation for that. There's the empty box that next to the TV that refers to a combination Laserdisc player. So I'm guessing that's what was there that they grabbed. But
also, she stole her own SNES.
Yes.
Well, if you're going to run away, you might as well take it with you. She did forget a couple games, though.
Yeah, it's true. But maybe those are the ones that she didn't like as much. I don't know.
Right, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. Adventures the Cat looked pretty sweet.
It looks pretty awesome.
Yeah.
He was definitely riding towards an explosion on a motorcycle.
Usually if you're on a motorcycle, you drive away from the explosion. But not Adventures the Cat. Just
That's not adventurous.
Yeah. No, I kind of high-fived the screen while playing because my wife and I have been watching the entirety of X-Files on Netflix. We started, I don't know, probably about a month, maybe two ago. So when I picked up the little piece of paper from the TV guide that had X-Files circled, I went, yeah, and kind of just raised my hand up slowly.
Well, then again, like, that is appropriate for the time period because it was the only thing worth watching in the mid-90s. So
pretty much, give or take. I mean, Twin Peaks was already off the air, so...
So, I guess, like, the next generation if you were desperate. But they had more class than that. They're watching X-Files.
So, you are passing up VR5.
Also, Next Generation around season 3 or 4 actually got good. So,
I'm glad you brought up Twin Peaks because occasionally the feeling I get, like, when I opened the door again to go into the floor and you see that stairs and the light kind of switches on and occasionally when just turning a hallway, I kind of got that same feeling that I would get that David Lynch could do to me with just like a single shot. Like in Twin Peaks in I can't remember the name of the house, but there's just that one shot that he does up the stairs that just unnerved me so much. So whether it was purposeful or not, you had some very well framed shots in there that just made me go.
It was definitely my biggest inspiration for like lighting the house was the way that interiors were lit in Blue Velvet specifically, like in the apartments and houses in Blue Velvet. Like there was a kind of stagey quality to it, but a lot of like overall dimness with spots highlighting different parts of the room in like a weirdly artificial way, but that's still really mundane and like almost believable. So anyway, they like tone of how the environment was presented was definitely something I was at least keeping in mind.
I think the only other thing that would have drawn me in more was that if it was in like a 4-3 ratio, and then it would have been like, oh, it is David Lynch, the video game.
You can play it in 4x3, right?
That's true. So back to the I lost myself. I'm sorry. No, I was going to X Files.
David Lynch film in 4:3. Did he do all of his movies? That could be right. Could that be right?
I don't know. I know. Obviously, Twin Peaks was.
Sure, it was on television.
Surely, Dune wasn't in 4:3.
No. I got it. But he could have made the stylistic decision to do like Blue Velvet in 4:3. I don't think that he did, but I could see it. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So X Files, 1990s. I read your interview on PC Gamer and kind of your answer to why 1995 is a setting, but I've also seen your Tumblr and your tweets about getting together to watch the X-Files movie on Laserdisc and stuff. So was it also sort of a guilty pleasure for you in addition to a narrative choice?
Yeah, I'm sure that it was something that, you know, I mean that we're at the beginning of a wave of general 90s nostalgia right now anyway, right? Like there's you're seeing way more movies and TV shows and you know, just like you go to a store, like you go to fucking Urban Outfitters or something, you know, and it's like all like Lisa Frank stuff everywhere and whatever else. Yeah. And I think it's a generational thing where we're like right on the leading edge of the people who are making things that people pay attention to are like in their early to mid 30s, and so now
also it's the 90s instead of the 80s buying things.
Right. Yeah, people with disposable income and everything. So I think we're just at the leading edge of a big 90s nostalgia wave generally. But, you know, like, yeah, so I imagine it's the kind of thing where it was a practical consideration to start with. And then as soon as we were like, well, we have the opportunity to put this in the mid 90s, because that's the most recent point in time where you wouldn't have had cell phones and email and everything. To also say, oh, and we could do something that was set when we were teenagers because we're nostalgic 30-something.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, thank you for making me super nostalgic and make me feel like I was in high school again and falling in love for the first time.
I mean, it's like, I'm glad we could do it. And I think that I assume that it led to a much more authentic production than if we had said, okay, let's set this in a time that we don't personally remember, you know?
Yeah.
Now when you guys were thinking about the time period, how do you think that in terms of Lonnie, excuse me, Lonnie, of Sam coming out to her parents? I mean, I would hope that it'd be easier for a kid nowadays to come out to their parents because it's a little more generally accepted than it would have been in the mid 90s. Did that play into how you laid out the storyline or her parents' reaction to that?
I think that it made it feel like it had a little bit more weight just because it was 15, 20 years ago and stuff was not as widely kind of acknowledged then, you know. It was before Ellen came out on TV and all that, you know, just sort of the visibility in everyday life was lower. And I mean, it's the kind of thing where once we figured out the angle of Lonnie, you know, going into the army, we were like, oh, this is right around when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was instituted. And then, you know, less than a year ago, right? It was taken out of commission.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of an interesting contrast, you know? Like, we had somebody that I know who played it. They were like, it's interesting how, you know, you could they were talking about how the game, you know, was a nostalgic game, and it's really easy for the message of nostalgia to be basically like, oh, stuff was so much better back then. And he was like, but it's cool in a way to see that in fact, like through some things like that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was instituted then is, and it's just recently been repealed, that it's almost also pointing out, oh, things are better now in a lot of ways, you know? Right. But we when we decided it was going to be sort of a suburban family that the story focused on, and we were talking about what the conflict was going to be, you know, I think that we had thought of the idea of, you know, the teenager being gay and that being like part of the conflict with the parents and the people at her school and everything before we had really said, and it'll definitely be set in this time, you know, because it's not like if this story happened now, it wouldn't still be a conflict, especially in, you know, some parts of the country more than others. But I do think that, you know, there was more of a culture of, you know, secrecy and denial and shame and whatnot around those issues, you know, 15, 20 years ago compared to now.
Why it's kind of, or I don't even know if this was intentional, but is that kind of why it was hinted that Sam and Katie's mother is Irish Catholic?
I don't think I hadn't really thought about her being Irish Catholic. I mean, she definitely has like an Irish background, but I think they're just like Presbyterian or something, you know, like just sort of.
So I guess I'm just reading into that.
Like a generic noncommittal, you know, middle American Christian, whatever.
I was thinking she'd be Irish Catholic because she immigrated.
Right.
And most Christians in Ireland would be Catholic.
But she immigrated from Polish?
Canada.
Oh, okay.
Read her last name and completely got that wrong.
No, she like, so her last name is Irish, but she immigrated from Canada, and she was born in Canada, though that's not ever stated. But she was a Canadian citizen, and she immigrated when she was like 25 or something. So I think that, yeah, she was born and raised in Canada and then came to the States when to marry Terry. But yeah, I think that, you know, we wanted to have the presence of Christian imagery in the house just because, you know, that's something that's very common in, you know, a middle class, you know, American household.
Well, it certainly wasn't overbearing. So.
Right. And that was the line I wanted to walk is, you know, like remembering my own upbringing, it was like, yes, my parents went to church. Yes, there were Bibles and stuff like that around the house. And I think that's true of a lot of people that I knew, but it was also not like a main driving factor of their identity or their daily life. You know, it's just sort of like, oh, there's this ambient presence of the fact that people, you know, believe in Christianity in this milieu, you know, in the space that you're occupying. Yes, these symbols exist here. But it not to be a very like religion versus progressive sexual politics, like, you know, like, binary kind of black and white conflict, but just sort of like, this is part of the family and the environment that she grew up in, and it's part of her parents' belief systems, and it's just one more factor in her life, like it is in a lot of people's lives.
It does pretty effectively communicate that Sam doesn't want to come out to her parents for a reason you know, being heavy-handed about it.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, because I always got the idea, you know, her parents were like baby boomers, probably came up in the 60s, and they may be a little bit like flower children, because I did see like the Earth, Wind, and Fire, like a big poster in the parents' room. So assume that you think they were a little bit, not if flower children but or hippies, but a little bit more progressive. I don't know if that went into your thinking at all.
Yeah, I think that I didn't think of them as being... I thought of them as being fairly moderate, right? Where it's the kind of thing where they would more naturally have conservative beliefs, but also like want to try to figure it out and work it out with their kids, but mostly not really like, you know, be kind of like Sam says at one point, not be super open-minded about things, but also not be, you know, like hardline reactionary, you know, conservatives. But it's like, even in that, in that kind of where they sit on the spectrum, it's still like a lot for those characters, I think, to deal with, right?
I grew up with my parents being conservative Muslims, and even conservative Muslims who think they're being very progressive are still conservative Muslims.
Right.
So when I was growing up, they always told me, you know, there's no reason for you to date. This isn't something that we do in our culture. So that's one of the reasons I actually ended up relating to Sam a lot, is because she was told that the way she thinks and the way her heart reacts is not the right thing to do.
Right.
And I ended up thinking, after I finished the game, like, that was one of the reasons I was envious of her, is that she cast all that off and just left.
Yeah.
And I never had that kind of courage when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I think that, that's a good point that you make, that, you know, even someone who's conservative that thinks they're being very open-minded, they're still coming from like a starting point, that it will make them react a certain way. And I think that that's kind of maybe the mixed message in what Sam was seeing through, was like, maybe her parents would say stuff like, you know, oh, you should tell us about everything and you can talk to us. But also she knew kind of what the weak points they were starting from when they would end up having a conversation.
It's kind of even worse that they just completely dismissed, like, this very important thing to her coming out. And they weren't even angry at it. They weren't disappointed. They weren't supported. They just, you'll get over it. That was kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, and the you know, punishment letter from dad that's just sort of like, okay, you can't hang out with your friends for a week, and then when you do, you know, you gotta keep your bedroom door open. You know, it's just sort of like,
I had that one with my with one of my old girlfriends in high school. So, well, if she's over, you gotta keep the bedroom door open, all right?
Well, then again, in the parents' defense, with the sort of letters Sam was leaving lying around, they probably knew.
That was actually one thing I really liked, and I don't know if it was intentional or not, but in all these places you find these hidden places that Oscar would store his, I guess, molesting tools would be the best way to put it. And
I don't think that's the best way to put it.
It's a way to put it.
And very slowly you see Sam sort of taking these places over. Like, she would just put her own, like, the things she was trying to hide, she would put in those hiding places, but for her they were empowering, and for Oscar they were his dirty secrets. And I kind of like that. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I like that she was taking over these parts of this house.
As she learned more about Oscar and this, the kind of the history of the psycho house, she started kind of using that to her hiding spots. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know how much she really knew about that stuff. Like the specifics of it. Like, obviously she found hidden compartments and things, but, yeah, I'm guessing that she did not know as much about Oscar as the player does. If you're paying attention,
there was stuff that I didn't put together, like the one-way door that went up to the bedroom from the basement. I was like, that's kind of strange. And then somebody pointed out to me, like, hey, do you realize what this actually means? I was like, oh, crap.
Yeah, I did not.
No, I didn't put that together at all like that. Old houses like that used to have passages for servants to get around. And it went down to the basement and then around to the kitchen. So that makes sense to me.
That's the general implication, is that, like, there are the servants' quarters down in the basement, and there's that little horrible dark room that the lights won't turn on in. And it has, like,
God damn you for putting that room in.
But it has, like, a bricked-up door on the far side of it. And some people have read into that and been like, oh, what's behind that door? That's, you know, it's like, well, no, the implication that we intended anyway was that there used to be a servant's entrance there.
Yeah.
And then at some point they stopped employing servants, so they bricked over that door so there wasn't, you know, a extra staircase that went down straight into their basement from the outside. But the idea was that, those passages were initially for servants to get around, but obviously they continued to exist past that point. And then
there was that toy horse.
Yeah.
Thoroughly creeped me out.
So did you ever think of a motivation for Terrence, why he moved into that house? Because that's the thing, that it's either something that's going to be really empowering as an answer, or something that's really makes me think less of Terrence.
What do you want it to be?
It's just that place has so much bad memories for him, and he just sort of went back and lived there. Like, did he think that he was over it, or did he not realize, like, how much that would affect him still? Because eventually, as you go through the game, you see him move his writing rooms away from that area over to the conservatory. So I'm guessing it worked out better for him later.
Yeah.
But early on, it seemed like it was still really causing him pain.
Yeah, I think the practical side of it was just, you know, neither he nor his wife are necessarily at jobs where they're, like, making an enormous amount of money. And I think it was just the baseline was, hey, we could sell our house and keep the money and just move into this old house that's huge and already paid off. And you know, so on and so forth. But then, yeah, probably part of the internal thinking was, you know, and Oscar's dead, so there's nothing left there to, for, you know, to, right. to keep me away from it. And so I'm gonna, kind of like you were saying, assume, oh, I'm over it. I can take ownership over this place. And then, yeah, part of the story is about sort of behind the scenes, him trying to actually have to face that.
Come, you know, to grips with it.
Yeah. And if there's anything we learned from Alan Wake, it's that writers tend to gravitate toward creepy old houses, whether they like to or not.
Yep. If
there's anything we learned from the Tom Hanks masterpiece, The Burbs.
If there's anything that we learned from The Shining, is that the writer should definitely go to a big, huge, old building in the middle of nowhere. It'll help their writing a lot.
Yeah.
And their relationship with their family.
Yeah. So speaking of kind of the secret passages and stuff, in one of the passages that comes out into the, I guess, like the library next to Terrence's office, there's the crucifix / light bulb pop.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is, I thought about today, like when I was playing the game, you know, I picked up the crucifix, the light bulb popped, and I made a beeline for the closest source of light. I just ducked it out of there. And, you know, I was sitting at work today thinking to myself, I was like, you know what, if that had happened in real life, if I was just kind of in, you know, in a place and a light bulb popped, I was kind of looked up and gone, ah, God damn it. So it's interesting how there's a video game me and then there's a real life me. And this game kind of played into that well, again, with kind of giving people a sense of urgency by maybe hinting towards something out of the ordinary or supernatural, but it not being there.
Well, I think probably in real life you also would have screamed and dropped the crucifix.
Okay, you might be right. You might be right.
Especially if you're in that big creepy house by yourself, just messing around with crucifixes and lights. Yeah, you probably.
Yeah, agreed.
Now, Steve, but, I don't know if like how much you actually have in like the layout and level design of this place. Down there in that same library, I don't know if this is just something I missed that people pick up later on, but it's the folder where you find the combination for the file cabinet. If you go to the sorry for the SMS or spam there, but if you go to the look through the those bookcases, like you can just barely see like a room on the other side of the bookcase, like through like the little gaps of the bookcases. That's like something like that's supposed to be there, or is just walled off, or
no,
if you're
not supposed to be anything there.
Okay,
now Steve's now loading up Gone Home.
I'm
in the editor right now.
I swear it's there. It's like if you look through the gaps, there's like one gap, and I spent like a half hour just like trying to find where the obvious switch was to open up the damn bookcase.
Is that why your time is
a U-shaped room? It's a U-shaped room, and most of the bookcases border on some other room.
It's possible. I'm now you're.
Maybe this is just a back face culling issue.
If you're talking about the bookcase where the folder actually is on.
Yeah.
Oh, that's in the center.
It's in the center?
No, the one that the folder is on is against the wall.
Yeah.
But in the gaps between them, I mean, there's just wall there unless it's like an occlusion problem. But the thing about that is that also on the other side of that wall, that the entire wall of the library is bordered by the hallway, so there's a room on directly on the opposite side of that wall, so there wouldn't be any way to there'd be a room there.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that the ghost controlled your mind.
it was
you into thinking that there's a phantom room there. The ghost is
probably trying to knock me off the trail of the real ghost room. It's probably exactly what's going on.
So speaking of, I actually, when I was playing through it on Friday night or Saturday night, I can't remember. There was a point in time where I considered, it was like, you know, I wonder if I go and change my computer system time, according to the notes that Sam and Lonnie made, if I'll actually see a ghost. There, a part of me was like, maybe Steve Gaynor and the Fulbright Company will put something like that.
I'm not that hardcore. I'm sorry.
No, just the Christmas duck and the mistletoe basket.
Yeah, that's in there. And there's the Easter egg with the, you know, with the cats.
With the what?
Oh, the basketball cats.
I have no idea what that is.
All right, you guys.
Breaking
got some,
news! Breaking news!
Yeah, we got some work to do.
You guys got some Googling to do when you're done with this podcast.
I did today find out about GoneHomeGame.com/ghost. I enjoyed that very much.
Well, it was necessary.
Yeah.
I had a friend that like he refused to play the game until we told him whether or not there were ghosts in it. I just kept telling him like it's important you don't know that there's ghosts, whether or not there's ghosts in it.
Yeah.
And eventually he decided to go Google it and spoil it himself.
Yes. I mean, I'm totally happy with telling people outright there's absolutely definitely no ghosts in any type or anything like that, because people will still go in being like, yeah, but I bet there it is.
Right. I mean, I went in, I'm thinking, I'm pretty sure there's no ghost or anything, but I still, had that feeling.
Probably a ghost.
Yeah. You know, I was creeped out by the whole idea of a ghost in that game until I read the note with Sam and Lonnie's spottings of the ghosts.
Yes.
And then the whole idea of a ghost was just adorable.
Yeah.
It had a very Scooby-Doo feel to it at one point.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but the excitement that those two characters had about ghosts was just palpable from that note.
It was really, she kind of embraced being the psycho house girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because she met someone who thought that was a cool thing.
True.
Right. Yeah. True. And I mean, it was just a good excuse for them to run around the house in the middle of the night, pretending that there's something spooky around the corner,
Can I tell you the thing I love most about this game is that we could totally talk about these people like they're really people.
Yes.
they're fleshed out enough that you can do that.
It's interesting to me because I feel like Katie was pretty fleshed out too. Like after I finished the game, like the only thought I really had is, she's going to be sitting on those stairs when her parents come home with those notes in her hand, and she's gonna have information about her father that she never wanted to know, information about her mother that she can't get out of her head, and she's going to be questioned about where her little sister is, and she can't answer.
Yeah, here's the question. Do you think she even tells her parents what happened to Sam?
I think she has to, because like all the stuff in the house is gone, and they're going to ask questions.
She could say the door was open when she got home.
Also,
Someone stole the cigars.
Also, the car is gone.
They shouldn't have left that key underneath the Christmas duck.
I think it's cool hearing people, wonder about and talk about that stuff. Because, I don't really know either, really. I mean, like, she could easily hide the notebook that you find at the end of the game, and say, I don't have any more information than you guys have, but I don't know if she would do that.
That would be a really dick thing for her to do, because one, like, the car is gone, most of their belongings are gone, her sister is gone, there's this horrible creepy like message on the answering machine. They're going to assume all the things we assumed for the 2 hours playing that video game. She's got to tell them, because it's a
just be like,
thing not to.
She'll just tell them, I went on this journey on the house. You guys can go do that now, too.
Right, got all the two.
Well, then you lock all the cabinets.
There's not that much stuff missing. And it's Sam's car, anyway. Sam has it. I don't know. Because, it's like, on the one hand, it really depends. Like, obviously, her parents are going to be looking, but does Katie want to try to basically give Sam a head start, or does she want to try and help her parents find her as soon as possible? Or, it kind of depends on what you think Katie's take on all the events that she's found out about are, I guess.
Yeah.
So is Lonnie AWOL?
Yes. Yeah.
But she is AWOL.
She would be. Yeah. Okay. I mean, she had an enlistment date and she didn't show up for it. So
I enjoy that. A lot of the questions on this podcast are not necessarily about the game, but just because we're so invested in this game and what happened. What else happened, Steve? Yeah. Tell us.
How does it all work out? Okay, that actually does bring me to a question that I wasn't sure on. Was a mother having an affair?
Do you?
Yeah, I don't. Well,
I didn't.
What do you guys think?
I didn't think so.
To the concert. We know that much because the ticket stub was in the heating vent, right?
Yeah.
So she went there, but she also talked about how this guy has a boyfriend or has a girlfriend out of town.
And there's also the condom in the parents' bedroom.
Which, by the way, that was like, you perfectly encapsulated the first reaction I remember having when I was a teenager and I found the condoms in my parents' drawer. I was like, gross, don't want to ever think about this again.
Yeah.
A lot of my thoughts changed on that when I was playing through it. Like, at first I thought, oh, there must have been an affair. That's why the parents' room looks like it's been ransacked, because one of them packed in a hurry to leave. And then, like, everything changed by the end of the game.
Well, I think that's the kind of the kind of thing you're supposed to think as you don't know the full story, but as you uncover it, you go up there and maybe you think that. I
assume they like packed in a hurry because, of course, the ghost.
So they see a ghost and then go pack and then leave.
Well, yeah, you don't want to just leave the house. You have to get a few things, you know?
Yeah. So coming from your level design background, how hard was it to get the house just the way you wanted it? How many iterations did it go through?
The basic, like the initial layout, especially for part one of the house, which was like the downstairs west hall, like the first half of the downstairs and the upstairs. I sketched out that layout and it basically stayed, but, what took a lot of time was just iterating on the proportions of each space. Like the rooms got a lot smaller over time, basically. Because when you build a big, when you don't have all the things to put in a space, you tend to be like, oh, this looks about right. And it does look about right just because the first person perspective doesn't tell you very much about the dimensions of the space. It's totally empty. And then you start putting couches and stuff in it. And you're like, oh my God.
This is a huge couch.
Yeah. I made a fucking Walmart here. You know, like it's just like, so there was a, you know, there were multiple passes of, okay, the TV room's too big, Sam's room is too big, the parents' room, you know, and just like pulling in the walls as much as possible, which is harder depending on what the dependencies of the space are. Like, I would have liked for the foyer actually to be smaller, but the foyer touches multiple spaces on all four sides, and it's just like, all right, fuck it, never mind. Like,
right, and you know, and like, of course, there's underneath the stairs, which is, I mean, one of the things I was like, man, that's a huge staircase, but yeah, it is a mansion, and there is the space underneath it.
Yeah, it is true that like the ceilings are very tall, but then you know, the rest of the spaces we iterated for a while on the layout of the east wing because we wanted to make it a little bit more interesting, you know. So we had like the dining room and the kitchen that had like that angled hallway between them and the greenhouse,
right, and they have the kind of
the dining room, all that stuff. But at some point, you know, you get locked into something and you just have to decorate it. But the other thing that's true about it is that like, really, the house is much more of a video game level than a super believable house. You know, like the layout of it, we get a lot of leeway because it's a sprawling old Victorian that's out in the country, you know? So, like, it's not like if it was in a subdivision, you'd be like, how the hell could this house be on one lot, you know? But it still is, you know, so, like, houses built around the turn of the 20th century were much more likely to have, like, long twisting hallways with rooms, you know, off to the sides of them instead of the kind of more common open plan construction that started in more like the middle of the century. So
also
like
we probably designed by the guy who owns it. It's not like it's like a plan from the developer.
Yeah, so, it was. I think that it was probably designed by Oscar's parents initially, you know, with an architect or whatever. But so you know, we had certain tools to pull on, but at the end of the day, the layout, it was more important for the layout to be good for the player flow and for level design and for like the readability of the space and like partitioning of the space so that you could remember what you had explored and didn't get turned around and stuff like that, than for it to be like the most literally accurate house layout in the world. And so hopefully we did a good enough job that it doesn't feel super fake at any given moment. But if you really try to rationally break down the layout of the house, it doesn't make a whole.
I think at first, especially when I walked into that main floor, I was like, wow, this is weirdly huge. But as I kind of learned what kind of house it was, I mean, I know I'd seen the title screen, but I don't think it quite clicked on to me that it was like a huge sprawling mansion, as you said. And as that became more evident, I was like, oh, okay, wow, this is a really weird house now. And it makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, so
the East Wing reminded me of, some of the older style construction houses I've lived in, just because those weird 45 degree angle walls and the way that the dining room is sectioned off from the rest of the house, I've lived places that are like that. That was kind of neat.
And somebody we did more research on the East Wing before we laid it out than we did on the West Wing and the upstairs. Like when we did the West Wing and the upstairs, I basically just drew it out on like a whiteboard. before, and I was like, this is how it should be. And then after when
even though the upstairs is like completely lopsided, when you picture what the house would look like from the outside.
But by the time that that we were playing out the second half of the house, Kate was working with us, and she did a bunch of research on how a Victorian would actually be laid out, and found a bunch of floor plans and stuff for us to refer to, and we kind of worked on that together. So I think the later stuff was probably laid out in a more believable way than the earlier floor.
I remember playing through when I first started, when I had no idea that it was an old creepy mansion that they had inherited. I thought, man, the upper middle class are really creepy people. No, actually, this is just creepy people. Okay, yeah, this makes more sense.
Yeah. So today, actually, I went back through, just curious, looked back through some of your old design blog, FulbrightDesign.com. And it was kind of leading up to your last post in February 2012, which kind of had a post about an idea kicking around in your head, which I maybe assume it was gone home. But before that, you were talking about Uzumaki, horror manga. Uh-huh. And I wonder how much those ideas maybe meshed and became gone home.
The thing that I talked about in that post was I like the idea of a normal, you know, like a seemingly mundane setting that as you investigate it further, you find what's weird or different about it, you know. And in the case of something like Uzumaki, it takes place in a modern, you know, sort of Japanese setting that just takes place in normal villages and houses, or, you know, towns and cities and stuff. And then there's something that's very otherworldly and unsettling and horror-like that gets injected into that. And so for Gone Home, I was a lot more interested in something that's, you know, like, I don't know, the idea that as you dig further into this place that is maybe a little weird on the surface, but still it's just a house that people live in, that what you find out about the people is inherently interesting just because people lead complicated lives, and getting invested in them and finding out what's happened to them is interesting, as opposed to their big crazy story twists that, you know, blow your mind and you're like, oh my God, these events are so extraordinary. It's more like the game gives you a way to get invested in events that are in fact totally ordinary, but the reason they matter is because you have gotten to know the people they haven't.
Sure.
My personal opinion of what I hope the rest of the video game industry takes away from this is that we don't have to save the world every time we play a video game, or the universe, or all of reality for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, there are stories that matter that are maybe not so high stakes.
Yeah. You know? Right.
In some ways, to me, this game is like the spiritual cousin, but completely unlike Journey, in that there's no big grand vista for you to explore, really, but it's still telling that same very basic, very personal story for just what matters to the player and the player character.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, I don't know, it's interesting to me, just because some of the stuff that has inspired us and that we were thinking about, or at least seeing parallels between, was stuff like, Journey, like you said, and like 30 Flights of Loving, you know, and these games that are expressly non-linguistic, you know, like they intentionally eschew almost all, if not all, language, you know, and it was, it's kind of interesting for us to be in a similar space where it's about navigating this space and, you know, discovering things in a nonviolent way, but that we're on the opposite side of that spectrum, and our game is all about reading and writing and talking and just like seeing a bunch of words, you know, like for a lot of it, but that it still has, it still covers some of the same ground of being kind of mostly quiet and being very hands off of the player and being about a personal journey.
Right.
Right. And I, again, looking back at your blog, I saw a couple of posts about kind of respecting the player and not necessarily maybe wasting their time.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that came through in Gone Home.
Well, that's good, yeah, because, I mean, the thing that we wanted was for the player to be very naturally motivated to play through the game and for it to be only their own curiosity and their own investment that was pulling them through playing and not us saying, go here next, now, go here, now do this, you know, do this so that you can get a sweet power-up or collect all 10 of the, you know, the lapel pins for your
the
collection
agility
or
orbs.
Whatever else. Right.
Although I do wonder how much, like, speed running you can do in this game, how much sequence breaking is really possible.
Oh, it's
a buddy of mine beat it in 4 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, the current record for speedrun with no modifiers turned on, I think, is 48 seconds.
Wow. And is there a sprint button I'm missing in this
I'm
game?
Guessing it loses something.
Yeah.
So do Sam's, like, voice dialogue just, like, come in and just not stop? Or do just, like, interrupt each other?
Layer over each other.
So the thing is, like, all of the secret panels and stuff, you can open from the beginning if you know where they are.
Oh, okay.
So the speed run is go through the front door, go under the stairs, get the attic key, go up to the attic, and hit the diary at the end. And that, do that in less than a minute. And then somebody else, yeah, did a 100% diary speed run where they got all 24 of the diaries. And I think that one's like 4 minutes and 30 seconds. And yeah, I watched it and it's awesome because it, like, the thing that I really like about it is it actually takes a lot of planning and strategy, you know, because he had to, like, he starts downstairs and then I think goes upstairs through the secret passage and then, like, through some of the upstairs and, you know, like, he has to do, he clearly, like, plotted it all out, you know, and found the optimal route to get everything in the most efficient order. And it was really cool to see. It was interesting. But yeah.
So as we kind of, maybe wrap talking about Gone Home, maybe before we start talking about other stuff, we actually, we've seen, and surely we don't agree with these people, complaints about Gone Home being, and I quote, sadly, too short to justify the price. And we disagree with these people, but we've come up with a couple of maybe time period relevant ideas that maybe you could put in the game to help these people get more out of it.
Okay.
And I know Mark Bradshaw suggested the laser tag mod or DLC. So it's kind of thematically appropriate. Nobody gets shot. For real, anyways.
Is that multiplayer? Do we have to put multiplayer in now?
Yeah, I mean, there would be an issue with that. I would assume at some point, maybe you can call Daniel in. Maybe the parents show up at some point.
Right. Yeah.
I'm going to assume Sam and Lonnie are still on the lam for this.
That'd be pretty rad, actually. Daniel shows up and he's like, "I came for some laser tag. You up for it?" He's like, "Why are you here at like 2 a.m?
That's great because now I have a voice for Daniel, and if I play this game again, that's what I'm going to hear.
I think a really good time lengthener would be trying to connect to a 14 4K modem and trying to read a comic. Because that would be a good 2 or 3 hours itself.
That would be pretty good. So one of the other days was, and I'm sure this one's been brought up, but playable Super Nintendo games. So Fully Playable Adventures, The Cat, Journey of the Crystal, yeah. Super Spitfire.
That was our original idea. Like, we made Super Spitfire first, and we...
Huh.
Wanted to make it so you could put it in the Super Nintendo, and we just didn't. Did you guys play Harvest End?
I have not, unfortunately. I think, Mark, have you played Minerva's Den, didn't you?
No, I... You know, the sad part is I have an Xbox 360, and I just have no room to download the stupid thing. And by the time I got a PC, it was like, well, I don't want to deal with Games for Windows Live, so maybe now I can play it now that Games for Windows Live is dying.
Yeah,
so.
I've been holding out for that Steam version, and thankfully, finally here.
Yeah.
What? Not here, is it?
Is it in the coming soon?
Is it?
They're killing Games for Windows Live and they're porting Minerva's Den to Steam?
Well, I'm Googling this now.
maybe they're just killing Games for Windows Live and you're screwed.
Yeah, I don't think there's actually a... Yeah, there's not an entry for it yet or anything.
GAF's thread is misleading.
Yeah, well,
what?
So...
Are you saying EOGAF got something wrong?
they did make like an app ID for it. Like, it's only in the back end. Like, apparently, I mean, you can see it publicly, apparently, because somebody sent me the link. So somebody at 2K made an entry for Minerva's Den in Steam. I don't know what that means. They aren't giving me any inside information. But yeah, fingers crossed. I would be really excited if
that would
get Minerva's Den through Steam finally. Just because I've had people like message me and be like, I bought Bioshock 2 through Steam. but what, I can't get them an early? I'm like, no, you have to go into the game and go into the DLC menu and it will put up games from Windows Live. Yeah, so anyway, point being, we made a little mini game in Minerva's Den that's called Spitfire that is kind of like Asteroids, sort of, like a cross between like Asteroids and like, I don't know, Space Invaders or something. And the idea was it was like the first video game that was made by the computer scientists in Rapture. And then at the end of the game, the main, oh, well, spoilers. Anyway, whatever. Let's just say, there would be a way for people on the surface to get access to the programming that was on the computers in Nervous Den. And so, yeah, we put Super Spitfire in there just as a little wink, like,
okay, so are we now confirming that Gone Home and Bioshock exist in the same universe? I think we are.
There are very mild implications that there might be some small overlaps.
I was going to say, so Super Spitfire, of course, would be the sequel to the original Spitfire, however many years later.
Version. And so we were going to make it so you could put it in the Super Nintendo and play it, and it just, we were, you know, we didn't have time to actually do it, right? So instead, we removed the Super Nintendo and put additional cartridges around, so that finding the cartridges is like a cool thing on its own.
And really, why would Lonnie and Sam leave the Super Nintendo behind?
Yeah.
You know?
You could have had to just get to the title screen and then lock up. Yeah. I was like, where are those Q-tips?
Yeah, but then people would want to rotate it towards the camera and then blow on it, you know?
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so of course you'd have to find the secret hidden Super Nintendo console somewhere in the house. Let's see. So a third-person New Game Plus mode where you defend yourself from zombies using limited ammunition and save points, and also you're a Raccoon City cop, and there's also an 8-second unskippable cutscene every time you open a door.
That sounds innovative.
8-second unskippable cutscenes would add a lot of time to this game.
That's true. You would,
you know, kids love 8-skippable...
The second you enter the first door, like a dog just jumps out.
You try to, that's the reason you can't go back out through the first door.
Also, there's a sliding puzzle thing. You don't have like one of the pieces, so you gotta find that.
Let's see.
Like this massive, complicated sliding puzzle, and then when you finally open it up, it's like Oscar's booze stash from the 40s.
Oh man, booze runners. Great. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. So after uncovering the attic, you play through the entire game in reverse, shutting all the doors and turning off all the lights. Maybe also a mirror mode.
Yeah, we could do an upside down castle thing.
Where, oh God! Yeah.
Flip the house upside down.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That's weirder than my idea. Yeah. Okay.
and then so this is weird for me because through most of the 90s, I was living abroad. I lived in Africa from 92 to 2000, so I only heard stories of POGs. And so you could include some sort of playable POGs game where you play POGs with a ghost in the house to earn in-game currency that can be used to purchase single-use items to turn lights on in rooms.
Or more POGs.
Or more POGs.
So you play POGs so that you can get light switches, basically, so that you can turn the lights on.
Right. You can, of course, also buy these light switches for 99 cents in the DLC store.
That's for the iPad version, of course.
Right, yeah.
We also talked about having working POGs. It's just a physics system. It wouldn't be that hard.
Yeah, I kept sort of a list of notes as I played through Gone Home. And one of the things that I wrote down, like my third note, my first one is chills up spine, second phone message. My second one is just pillow fort. And then my third one is threw book JFK on chair and the chair spun. Like that just tickled me. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, that was a very intentional decision. Like, so, okay, that was another thing that was born out of a technical constraint. So, because of reasons, the player doesn't actually collide with physics objects in the game. It basically just makes things really janky. Like, doors collide with you and stuff, but if you were, like, if you threw a book on the floor and then you could, like, kick it around and shit, I don't know, things just got weird.
Oh, God.
So it meant that I made that chair so that it could rotate like it does, but the player couldn't rotate it by just, like, walking into it. To do something with that, I put the book on the chair and I just made it so there's not a putback trigger.
Because I put everything back in its place. Right. Everything, which was nice because it kind of would, I think, pulled me out of the game if I tried to like set down a picture frame and it just kept like falling off the table or something.
Yeah. No, that was in our very first playtest round, we didn't have the putback system. and you know, people were like, I picked up a trophy off the shelf, and then I spent like 10 minutes trying to put it back, and it just fell over.
And now it's in the toilet.
The sad part is, inside, in your head, you're probably thinking, because mom and dad are going to be mad when they get home.
That was actually my exact thought.
I turned off all the lights and closed the doors when I left rooms after I read the note about, oh God, Sam, you're just as bad as your sister.
That was like, a great note. That was such a great note.
So I have a kind of major question for you. At the end of the game, Sam runs off with Lonnie, and she basically throws her entire life behind her. To make this game, you ended up leaving 2K and kind of pretty significant projects. How much of that was reflective of how much of the ending was reflective of your own career choices?
I don't know. I mean, it's I'm sure that there are parallels, and if you play Minerva's Den, there are also thematic overlaps with just like two people that want to be together and for whatever reason they can't, and that's part of the challenge that they face, and how that resolves is, you know, the thrust of the story and everything. And yeah, maybe Gone Home reflects that in a way that is kind of more hopeful or more directly relevant to like, yeah, the most recent events in my life. But yeah, I don't know. That, I mean, it's a fair observation, but I hadn't thought of it in those particular terms.
Okay.
Have you ever seen Jacob's Ladder?
Yeah.
Was that one of your influences? Because that's all I could think about at the end of the game.
I mean, I've seen it, but no, I wouldn't say that had a direct influence on it. You're thinking in the sense of like you were expecting it to all have been a dream or something?
No, just I don't. Maybe it's just me, but the sense of relief at the end.
Oh, okay.
The feelings of no, it's not good. It's like it's not a happy ending.
Yeah.
But you feel relieved at the end.
It's a hopeful ending.
Yeah.
But that's not true of Jacob's Ladder at all, or at least the version I saw. Really? Okay.
That's the way I felt at the end of Jacob's Ladder. I mean, he's dying, but
yeah,
the angels are coming to bring him to heaven.
Okay. All right. Okay. I guess.
And it's his own fear of death that brings on all the horror themes.
Right. Okay. So then, right. As far as like reconciling his fears of death and that being,
yeah, when he lets go of life, then he can see the angels bringing him to heaven. Yeah. You know, when Sam lets go of her fear, she can go be with Lonnie.
Right. Well, have you
ever, maybe that's all in my head. Yeah.
No, I mean that's a cool, interesting parallel. It's not something I was thinking of at the time, but I totally buy it. Have you ever seen the movie called Dead Man? It's a Jim Jarmusch movie. It stars Johnny Depp. It's a Western.
I have not.
Okay, you should watch the movie Dead Man. And just because of the parallels to what you were saying about Jacob's Ladder, and something, my interpretation of it anyway, I don't know how widely held it is, but I guess I would say just the journey and the title of the movie, I guess just keep them in mind while you're watching it. It's totally worth watching. I think you'll
have to do that. Do you know if it's on Netflix or anything?
I don't know, but I think I watched it on Netflix, but it was years ago. So
yeah, yeah. I'll have to investigate that.
So are you getting the whole Georgia O'Keeffe experience now? How for years people would tell her what her art was about and she'd have to be like, no, that's not what I did at all.
No, not really. I mean, you know, you guys, no, I don't think that you guys are like far off. Because the thing is, like, there are a ton of totally valid interpretations, right? What I was thinking about or what my intent was at the time is definitely not the only thing that's relevant. And it's super interesting to hear people make connections that I hadn't thought of. So I think it's really cool.
Yeah. Do you have any questions for us, the players of your game that you guys just put out?
Let me think about that for a second. I guess, did anybody end up like, you know, did you all play through it in basically the same order and find the same stuff and everything, or did you guys have any discussions where
we haven't really had a chance to talk about it together? I just played it this past Saturday and you know, weekend, and then podcast on Monday. So
yeah,
I know I missed the crucifix the first time, so like when people started talking about that kind of jump scare, I had no idea what they meant.
Still have no idea what you're talking about.
I never found the crucifix. I never found the combination for the safe. But then at the end of it, I never felt any real need to go back either. It feels like I'd be kind of cheaping the experience by trying to 100% that game.
I have like this mentality, or I don't know, like an algorithm that I almost go through if I'm playing a game that has different areas to explore. Yeah. Like Diablo 3, like, okay, if I go into a room and I can go straight, left, or right, I will go left first, then right, and then straight. And yeah. And that's kind of the approach I took when I played this. And I don't know, I feel like I went in the order that maybe you wanted me to.
Right.
So, I went into the leftmost wing, the west wing first, or whatever direction is. And, and I kind of just progressed through the rooms in the order that they came to me at.
Right.
Well, I do know that when when you have the west wing at the, you go into the foyer, right? And then there's the room off to the left was you got that wing, right?
Yeah.
I avoided that as far as long as possible because,
because of the hallway.
Yeah, that's a scary ass hallway, man. I don't know what's going on.
I avoided the second floor for as long as I could because Imran, I was asking Imran before, can you go back and see things once you finish the game? And you mentioned that the last save point is in the attic. So I just thought, I don't want to go upstairs. I want to check everything else out.
Is for me, when I was upstairs, like I saw the lights on and I saw the note that said like, do not enter when lights on. And so it's like, okay, well, if Sam's up there, I don't want to go up there. The lights are on. And so I avoided the attic until it was the very last place that I could go to.
You know, the lights were on and Sam leaves a note that says, don't come in when the lights are on.
Yeah. Like, I didn't
and also in the garage, there's a bike with Lonnie's hat on it. So I didn't, like, when it finally came time to go in the attic, I didn't want to go up there because I thought they'd both be up there and I'd be invading their privacy.
Well, they can't be because the car is gone. Like, once you notice the car is gone, Sam's nowhere near.
Somehow I noticed the bike, but didn't, I missed the fact that Sam has a car.
They could have parked outside. You never know.
Like, if I could play this game over again without any knowledge of what was going to happen, I would like leave myself a note from the future that says, read everything twice.
Yeah. I not only did I read everything, I never thought that I would look at all sides of as many toilet paper packages that I did.
I can't tell you how many times I turned that train over.
There was that one note that you absolutely cannot look at twice because, she said, nope, not picking that thing up again. Nope, go to hell.
Which, if you have siblings, you understand that feeling of, nope, just never want to look at this again.
Yeah.
Do you guys have
I have an older brother, which actually it made me sympathize with Sam way more because he's the he's the perfect academically excelling brother. Right. So when I saw Sam's story about the ovum and the sperm and all that, then I saw Katie's like completely rote and like regurgitated story that got the perfect score. I was like, yep, that's how it works.
I love how even the smallest things have like little twists in them. Like that story got to see me after class, and then later you find out it's because she's recommending this summer intensive writing course.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't put that together.
Yeah. What? You know what? I didn't put that together. that's really good.
I meant to do that.
Have
you seen the Forbes article yet?
Which they did a review, right? Yeah, I read that when it first came out.
I don't know if it was the same review, but I read one of the reviews in Forbes, and the guy was he was really mad at Sam for luring Lonnie away from the army. And it's like, okay.
We got an indignant tweet or something. There was somebody saying like, I can't believe that people are so excited about this story. The values. Love over a good education.
Oh my god!
I think it was actually serious. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah. No, I've no
that
doubt.
Is accurate for teenager.
Yeah. I guess so.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Steve Gaynor, Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Of course, Gone Home is the game we talked about pretty much this whole time. GoneHomeGame.com or GoneHomeGame.com/ghost if you want to get a discount on the game. I'm just kidding. That's not true. That's not true. So yeah. So thanks a ton for coming and joining us and chatting us tonight with this awesome game that you've made.
And thank you so much for making this game. Like, I've been beating the interactive fiction drum for years, and this is my exhibit A from now on when I want to show people what video games can do for stories.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, all you guys, for playing. And it was a lot of fun coming on the show. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem at all. Bye.
Bye, thanks, everybody.
Steve.
Bye.
Bye, Steve.
Bye.